Chapter 37, The Road to Delphi. Though we had gone to bed so late the previous night, Terry and I rose early, and on going on deck soon afterwards, found hardly anyone about. It was a fine, clear morning. The sea could not have been more calm, and we were sailing between the mainland and some four or five small, widely separated islands. Despite the muffled hum of the ship's engines and the occasional muffled shout coming from the swimming pool, there was a breathless hush in the air, and as I gazed out over the dark blue waters, it was as though time stood still, as though nothing had changed, and that I was seeing what Homer, had he not been blind, might have seen 3,000 years ago. I felt much as D.H. Lawrence must have felt when he wrote, as he passed that way, "Now the sea is the Argonaut's sea, and in the dawn Odysseus calls the commands as he steers past these foamy islands. Wait, wait, don't bring me the coffee yet, nor the pain grillé. The dawn is still off the sea, and Odysseus's ships have not yet passed the islands. I must watch them still." I don't remember if Terry and I were brought any coffee that morning or any pain grillé, but we had swallowed a cup of tea before going on deck, and probably were still standing at the rail when the ferry reached Corfu, the largest of the Ionian Islands, where a few passengers disembarked. 2 hours later we were in Igoumenitsa, and after a delay in the customs, found ourselves on the road to Yanina, the provincial capital, 64 miles away. It was exciting to be in Greece at last, exciting that a dream had come true, and we were actually on our way to Delphi. The countryside through which we were passing was brown and desolate, while above a certain altitude, the sides of the mountains were entirely devoid of vegetation. Presently we saw a few miserable stone huts, though little evidence of any cultivation. As we approached Yanina, however, we started to see extensive fields of what I eventually recognised as tobacco, which I had not known was produced in Greece. There are also people on donkeys, and standing in a dusty yellow field, evidently just harvested, two bearded Orthodox priests in black gowns and cylindrical headgear could be seen bending and straightening up, as between them they lifted bundles of what seemed to be hay onto the back of a donkey. They moved slowly and stiffly, in a way that combined the laboriousness of the peasant and the dignity of the priest. The scene could well have been painted by the Millet of the Angelus, and it moved me deeply. Immemorially pastoral and immemorially patriarchal. It was reminiscent of the time when farmer, priest and father were one and the same person, and when the powers of earth served religion and the forces of religion blessed the earth. There was nothing pastoral about the filling station at which we stopped shortly before reaching the town, and nothing patriarchal about the voluble shell agent we encountered there. Petrol was expensive, though whether because it was more heavily taxed in Greece than in the other countries through which we had passed, or because it was a case of the wily Greek taking advantage of the innocent foreign travellers, we had no means of telling. In Yanina we parked beside an extensive lake, over the waters of which there was a view of the domes and minarets of what appeared to be a mosque. Epirus had been part of the Ottoman Empire for 500 years, and Turkish cultural influence was still very much in evidence. While we were resting after lunch, three inquisitive Greek boys appeared, one of whom proceeded to catch and dismember a crayfish, though whether with a view to cooking and eating it or out of sheer devilment was unclear. From the lake we drove to the town centre, where we strolled round what I could not help calling the bazaar, and where the shops were as poor and shabby as those of small-town provincial India. In one of these shops I bought a blackened green pottery wall plate of the head of Achilles, not realising that in the course of our 3 weeks in Greece we would be seeing scores, even hundreds, of souvenir shops, and tens of thousands of cheap, mass-produced souvenirs of every kind. Achilles and the events of the Trojan War had been familiar to me since my boyhood, initially from a little book called The Story of the Iliad, which my father had given me, and later from the Iliad itself, in Chapman's translation, a second-hand copy of which I picked up in Bideford during the war, and which I read in a state bordering on ecstasy. I was particularly delighted with the episodes in which the gods and goddesses appear, whether it was Hera whipping up the celestial horses and driving herself and Pallas Athene down from the heights of Olympus to the earth, the axle of the chariot groaning beneath the combined weight of the two goddesses, or Aphrodite being wounded in the hand by the Greek hero Diomedes as she removes her son Aeneas from the fray, or Thetis rising from the depths of the sea, stealing up to the throne of Zeus and prevailing upon him to give victory to the Trojans, until the Greeks gave due honour to her son, the valiant and glorious Achilles, who was fated to die young. Zeus was king of the gods, and his oracle at Dodona claimed to be the eldest of the oracles of this Hellenic world. We arrived there from Yanina early in the evening, having turned off into the green, peaceful valley from the Arta Road, and spent a couple of hours looking round the archaeological area, where except for the partly restored theatre, there was little to be seen other than the exposed foundations of various ancient buildings. Whether on account of the bare mountains by which it was shut in, or because of the lingering influence of the feeling of awe with which visitors must have approached this sacred site, there was a strange quietness in the atmosphere of the valley, a quietness that was more than mere absence of sound. In classical times, the oracle was regarded as having its seat in the leaves of an oak, the whisperings of which communicated the god's responses to the questions put to him. Originally, however, the place seems to have been the seat of a dream oracle, the dreams coming to the attendant prophets, the Seloi, as they slept on the bare ground. There is an allusion to Dodona and the Seloi in the Iliad, in the speech in which Achilles prays to Zeus for the victory and safe return of his friend Patroclus, whom he has sent to fight against the Trojans in his place. Quote, "High Zeus, lord of Dodona, Pelasgian, living far off, brooding over wintry Dodona, your prophets about you living, the Soloi who sleep on the ground with feet unwashed. Hear me. At one time, before when I prayed to you, you listened and did me honour, and smote strongly the host of the Achaeans. So one more time bring to pass the wish that I pray for." Within the archaeological area there stood a big old tree, more trunk than branch, that may or may not have been an oak, and may or may not have been the lineal descendant of the tree in whose leaves the oracle had had its seat. Probably because there was no wind, we heard no whisperings from the scanty foliage above our heads, neither did we see any trace of the Siloi, although at 10 o'clock the site's young Greek attendant came to lock up for the night, so to speak. He was friendly and inquisitive, as were two young Greeks who had turned up earlier and who came and visited us at the little bus the following morning. Such visits were to be a common feature of our journey through Greece, especially when we were in the more out-of-the-way places. No sooner had we settled down for the night, or simply stopped for a meal and a rest, than one or two young men, usually two friends, would appear from nowhere and approach us, sometimes after loitering for a while in our vicinity. In France and Italy, such a thing had not happened even once. Communication often began with the young men smilingly asking, "You have cigarette?" The question being put in a way that did not quite amount to a request, but was more than just a simple inquiry. Terry and I would thereupon be forced to explain that we were non-smokers and had no cigarettes, and as our visitors had little English, usually no more than the three words already spoken, and we had no Greek, we had no alternative but to shake our heads vigorously, spread our fingers wide, and shrug our shoulders, and hope that they would understand what we meant. Probably they did understand, for they never took offence at our failure to produce any cigarettes, and remained as friendly as before. Their inquisitiveness was directed as much to the little bus as to Terry and me. They walked round it slowly and admiringly, peered through the windows, and were evidently much taken by the way it was fitted out within. One young man, after peering inside, turned to us in surprise, saying, No women. The most common inquiry after you have cigarette was German or English. In certain places, the latter was indeed the initial inquiry, and no smiles would be forthcoming until the question of our nationality had been cleared up. The Germans had attacked and overrun Greece in 1941, and the wounds of war were taking a long time to heal. Once the young men had satisfied their curiosity, they would drift away, disappearing as quietly as they had arrived on the scene. They appeared to have nothing to do and may well have been unemployed. Rather to my surprise, Terry seemed not to mind these intrusions upon our privacy. Sometimes he appeared almost to welcome them. This was only partly due to the obvious inoffensiveness of the intruders, if such they could really be called. It was also due to the fact that, as could be safely assumed, they were not more educated and more knowledgeable than he was, and that there was no question, therefore, of his being at a disadvantage with them. Even had they happened to be more educated and knowledgeable, in the absence of a common language, this would not have become apparent. Thus, there was no danger of my friend being made to feel inadequate and inferior, as sometimes was the case in England, and he could meet the advances of our friendly, inquisitive young visitors in a natural, easy manner. The truth was that Terry really liked people, and became anxious, and therefore stiff and reserved, only when he felt threatened by their superior education and knowledge. There were times when I thought he felt threatened even by me, though the fact that in certain fields he was the more knowledgeable of the two should have been enough to rule out any feelings of this kind. I might know more about religion and philosophy, but he knew more about the practicalities of modern urban living. If I was to stay on in the West indefinitely, as I had now decided to do, I would need to know more about those practicalities. I already knew a little about them, thanks to Terry, and could expect that in time I would know as much as he did. In that case, there would be an imbalance between us. He might feel threatened, and this could affect our friendship. But that was all in the hypothetical future, and it was best not to speculate. Now we were at Dodona, within sight of the big old tree that may or may not have been an oak. The two young Greeks had just paid their second visit, Terry seeming not to mind the intrusion, and it was now time for us to leave. We left at 10 o'clock, not without regrets, driving back through the green and peaceful valley and rejoining the highway. Many wild flowers, notes my diary, along banks of Lauros River, through fine mountain scenery to Arta. Lauros, the name conjures up a vision of crystal clear waters, waters that wound their rapid way between smooth grey boulders and were half hidden by overhanging trees. So beautiful was the river, and so mysterious in its flow, that it was not difficult to believe, as an ancient Greek would have done, that it was the haunt of nymphs, and that one might, if one was lucky, catch a glimpse of two or three of them sporting in the water. In Arta we stayed only long enough for Terry to photograph some storks. We had seen storks in Yanina, nesting on the chimney tops, but here a pair of them had built their big, untidy nests on the top of a tall, rather ornamental church tower, and the opportunity was too good to miss. With an eye to the lucrative travel brochure market, Terry had already taken shots of the Grand Canal in Venice, and of divers, tiny figures silhouetted against a sky of ultramarine, about to plunge from a huge rock on the Adriatic coast. But I suspected his heart was not really in the work, reminiscent as it was of the job he had so recently quitted. At Amphilochia, we stopped again, there being a magnificent view over the Gulf of Arta, and Terry took a few more photographs. We then headed for Stratos, the old capital of the area, which was just off the main road, in the hope of finding there a place to park during the hot afternoon hours. On the way we passed three lakes, one large and two small. Though pleasant to look at, the large lake smelt badly, and it was very windy. In Stratos, our hopes of finding somewhere to park were quickly dashed. The place turned out to be no more than a tumble-down village plus a few ruins, and we decided to press on to Agrinion. Unfortunately, we missed the town, probably bypassing it, and in the end simply drove into a convenient field and parked beneath a tree. Here, for the next 4 hours, we camped, on this occasion without any friendly, inquisitive young men intruding on our privacy. We had lunch. I read Euripides's The Madness of Heracles. In years to come, the figure of this, the greatest of the Greek heroes, with his lion skin and his club, was to occupy a special place in my imagination and be the subject of one of my longer poems. That Heracles, or Hercules as he is called in the poem, was not so much the boisterous, brutal Heracles of popular legend as the altruistic Heracles whose might was at the service of right and who for centuries had been the patron saint, so to speak, of the Stoic philosophers of Greece and Rome. Traces of this altruistic Heracles were to be found even in the oldest legends. In Euripides' play itself, the chorus of Theban elders, having lamented the passing of youth, breaks out in praise of memory and of the greatness of Heracles, singing, "Proud theme hath minstrelsy, to sing mine hero's high achieving. He is Zeus's son, but deeds hath done whose glory mounts, far leaving the praise of birth divine behind, whose toils gave peace to humankind, slaying dread shapes that filled man's mind with terror's ceaseless haunting." Since Heracles' toils, no doubt a reference to the famous 12 labours, gave peace to humankind, and thus were of an altruistic character, their glory surpasses the praise due to the hero as son of the king of the gods. Indeed, it is altruism itself that is the true divinity, and Heracles is to be praised, even worshipped, not on account of his supposed divine paternity, but as the embodiment of altruism. Embodying as he does the principle of altruism, he exemplified, for the Stoics especially, a definite ideal, an ideal that may be regarded as representing, on its own ethical level and within its own Greco-Roman cultural context, the transcendental altruism that is exemplified for Buddhists in the idea of the infinitely wise and boundlessly compassionate Bodhisattva, who, in the words of the devotion to Tara, quote, "labours for the weal of all beings." Euripides' play was still giving me food for thought when, shortly before 6 o'clock, we struck camp and drove coastward to Missolonghi. It was in this nondescript little town that Byron had died in 1824 at the age of 37, the victim, it has been said, as he was the author of his own legend. One of our books on Greece described Missolonghi as being situated on the edge of a wide, stagnant lagoon, only navigable by flat-bottomed boats. But we saw nothing of either the lagoon or the boats, and very little of the town itself, other than the fat brown pipes of the new sewerage system. All the roads having been dug up for laying them, it was difficult to get around, and we therefore had to drive on without seeing the museum or the statue of Byron. Between Missolonghi and Naupactus, as if to compensate us for any disappointment we may have felt, there was a fine view of the Gulf of Petras to the south and west. Naupactus, renamed by the Venetians as Lepanto, was situated further along the coast on the Gulf of Corinth. As Lepanto, the town had given its name to the great sea battle of 1571, in which the combined Christian forces under Don Juan of Austria, the half-brother of Philip II of Spain, had inflicted a crushing defeat on the forces of the Ottoman Empire. From the Christian point of view, it was a famous victory, and one that G.K. Chesterton celebrates with his usual gusto in his poem Lepanto, which I had more than once encountered in anthologies of 20th century poetry. Since we were hoping to reach Delphi that night, we drove straight through Naupactus, as it was again being called, without stopping to see the remains of either Venetian or Turkish occupation. For the second time that day, our hopes were dashed, this time in a more serious manner. Our route lay through the mountains, and we were not long out of Naupactus before we hit a 15-mile stretch of extremely bad road. To make matters worse, night fell, and as there was no moon, we had to find our way by the light of our headlamps as best we could. The road was evidently being widened. Rocks had been blasted and trees felled on either side of it. In places it was impassable, and the little detours that had been created were no more than the roughest of rough tracks. Driving was not only difficult, but dangerous. More than once we found ourselves on the edge of a precipice, and more than once we had to cross what appeared to be a ravine by means of a bridge that was no more than half a dozen tree trunks laid edge to edge and covered with a layer of dirt. Progress was therefore painfully slow, and it was only after at least 3 hours of anxiety that we were clear of the roadworks and again on tarmac. Before long we saw in the distance the lights of the little mountain village of Mornos. The lights shone brightly, but no sound was to be heard, as though no one was living there. So many and so bright were the lights, and so profound the silence, that it was positively eerie, and I was reminded of old tales in which a wandering knight, lost in the depths of the forest, at midnight sees lights glimmering among the trees, and rides towards them, not knowing if they were those of a king's castle, a hermit's chapel, or a sorcerer's magically created palace. As there was no campsite in Mornos, we drove straight through this strange little place without stopping, and eventually the road having descended out of the mountains and into a small valley. In this valley we spent the night, the last night of the outward part of our journey. It was Delphi we had come all this way to see, and once we had seen Delphi, we would be homeward bound, however wide a detour we might thereafter make, and whatever else of importance or interest we might happen to see on the way back. Delphi was the perihelion of the orbit of our journey. It was the point at which we would be spiritually nearest to the mysterious force that, for the ancient Greeks, was embodied in the great and glorious figure of Apollo, god of the sun, music, poetry, and prophecy. Henry Miller wrote about Delphi within a year of his visiting the place. I am having to write about my own visit 34 years after it occurred, so that despite the help provided by a few diary notes, there was no question of my being able to write about my impressions of the sacred site with the freshness and immediacy, not to mention the genius, of the author of The Colossus of Marusi. Having passed a quiet night in the small valley, in the morning, Terry and I drove over the hills into another valley, in which there were tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, of olive trees, all growing so close together that from a distance it was as though the floor of the valley was covered by a sea of silver-green foliage. At our approach, the sea divided, so to speak, and we drove on through Bonitura and Amphissa, after which several miles of straight road took us through more olive groves, up to Crouson. From Crouson, which must have been several thousand feet above sea level, there was a view back over the Gulf of Corinth that my diary is content to describe as magnificent, and which must have been truly so. At 9 o'clock in the morning, on Sunday the 3rd of July, we reached our destination. Henry Miller had come upon Delphi at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, after driving up from Athens. It was midwinter, and there was a mist blowing in from the sea, and seen in that strange twilight mist, the ancient site had seemed even more sublime and awe-inspiring than he had imagined it to be. Later it rained. Terry and I arrived early in the day, at the height of summer, and instead of mist from the sea, there was only a slight haze. Unlike Henry Miller, I had not imagined Delphi to be sublime and awe-inspiring, or in fact anything else, so that whether the place exceeded my expectations or fell short of them was not a question that could arise. Such imaginings were in any case utterly irrelevant. The last bend of the road once turned, the prospect that lay before us was one in which there was a perfect harmony of the sublime and the beautiful, of the work of nature and the creations, now fragmentary and ruined, of the human brain and hand. Delphi was situated on the steep lower slope of Mount Parnassus, in a kind of natural amphitheatre, with the Phaedrides, or shining rocks, rising high above it to the north, and with a view southward across the Pleistocene Gorge to the mountain range beyond. The sacred precinct, within whose walls the great temple of Apollo had once stood, occupied what appeared to be the centre of the amphitheatre. On the mountainside, here and there among the ruins, grew olive, fig, and pomegranate trees, as well as slim, dark cypresses, all bathed in the calm morning sunshine, beneath a sky intensely blue. Deeply impressed though I was by the sublimity and beauty of the scene, what I felt most strongly about Delphi was that it was a holy place. I had been in holy places before, notably in Bodh Gaya, Sarnath and Kusinara, and other Buddhist holy places of northern India. These sites were holy by virtue of their association with events in the life of the Buddha. In Bodh Gaya, he had attained supreme perfect enlightenment. In Sarnath, he had taught his first five disciples. And in Kusinara, he had died. And each of these places had its distinctive atmosphere. That of Bodh Gaya was intense and powerful. That of Sarnath, joyful and expansive. That of Kusinara, solemn and mysterious. And so on. Delphi was different. It was not holy by virtue of its association with a particular event, at least not of the historical order. Delphi was itself holy. It was not a holy place simply because it was there that Apollo's temple and oracle were located. Temple and oracle were located at Delphi because Delphi was a holy place. It was as if the very earth was holy, and as if this holiness penetrated the rocks and the trees and permeated the air, so that one felt it in the warmth of the sun and drew it in with every breath. Though the temple was in ruins, and though the oracle had been silent for more than 1,000 years, Delphi was still a holy place, and its influence could still be felt. I certainly felt that influence during the 2 days Terry and I stayed there, despite the noisy tourists, of whom there were quite a few wandering among the ruins even at 9 o'clock in the morning, and who arrived by the coachload throughout the day. Our first visit was to the two temples of Athene Pronoia and the Tholos, which stood with a few smaller structures on a terrace below the road, well away from the sacred precinct. All three were, of course, in ruins. Three fluted Doric columns with a section of entablature bringing practically all that survived, more or less intact, of the Tholos, a mysterious circular structure, the purpose of which is unknown. From the sanctuary of the Marmoria, as the place was called, we made our way round to Castri, the small town or large village adjacent to Delphi, though out of sight, so far as I remember, of the sacred precinct and the other ancient sites. What we took to be the principal street was lined with souvenir shops, and we spent some time looking at reproductions of the various types of ancient pottery, red, red and white, black, and black and green in colour, and of every imaginable size, shape and decorative style. Almost without exception, they were extraordinarily graceful, and the thought that the ancient originals were for the most part articles of everyday household use gave rise to some very Ruskinian reflections, not all favourable to modern civilization. Having already bought a wall plate in Yanina, I did not buy anything, but Terry bought 2 hand-woven bags, one for his mother and one for Vivian. Souvenir shops not being the only ones in Castri, we were able to buy a loaf of good Greek bread and a pot of good Greek yoghurt, both of which we had already come to appreciate, sometimes making a meal of the latter. In the afternoon, having lunched back at the little bus, we visited the Castalian Spring, which was situated 1/2 mile to the east of the sacred precinct and was dedicated to Apollo and the Muses. Earlier in the day, we had seen it running down the hillside through the olive groves near the Marmaria. Now we were at its source. The cold, clear water came gushing from a deep cleft in the Phaedriades and poured into the court of an artificial grotto. Bending down, we scooped a little of it up in our hands and drank. Originally, people had purified themselves at the Castilian spring before approaching the oracle, but in later, post-classical times, the waters came to be regarded as a source of poetic inspiration. Purified and inspired, or at least refreshed, we then made our way down to the ruins of the gymnasium complex, with its double running track, one indoor and one outdoor, its Greek and Roman baths and other buildings, which stood on a terrace a little higher than that on which stood the ruins of the Marmaria. Much of the site was overgrown, besides being surrounded not so much by groves as by a whole forest of olive trees, so that few tourists ventured there. In the welcome shade of a cluster of the bushy-headed old trees with their silver-green foliage, we sat down and read. I read an interesting but confused book on the history and mythology of Delphi, Terry a book on Zen by D.T. Suzuki, to whose writings and the Lankavatara Sutra he remained faithful for much of our journey. After a while I became aware that my friend was feeling very depressed, so that I laid aside my book, he had already laid aside his, and we had what my diary terms a little talk. Apparently he was depressed because Delphi was far more crowded than we had expected it to be, depressed because some of the tour groups were quite rowdy, and depressed, most fundamentally, because our being surrounded by the remains of an ancient civilization and culture about which he knew very little served to remind him of his lack of education, and thus to trigger those feelings of inferiority and inadequacy that were never far from the surface. Just what I said to Terry I do not remember. I never attempted to argue him out of his depressions, or to convince him that, since there was no reason, objectively speaking, for his depression, he ought not to be feeling depressed. Much less still did I ever urge him to snap out of it. Usually, after acknowledging that he felt depressed and empathising with him, not having suffered from depression myself, I did not find this easy, I would gradually change the subject and start talking about something which was of interest to both of us and calculated to evoke a positive response from him. This served to divert his attention from the depression, which, as he became more and more engrossed in the topic under discussion, would little by little subside of its own accord. Probably this is what happened that hot afternoon as we sat in the shade of the olive trees among the ruins of the gymnasium complex. In any case, as a result of our little talk, Terry regained his cheerfulness, at least for the time being. But as it was now 4 o'clock, we repaired to the little bus to partake of the cups that cheer but not inebriate, generously laced with condensed milk, though in view of the classical nature of our surroundings, a beaker full of the warm south, full of the true, the blushful Hippocrene, would no doubt have been more appropriate. Thus fortified, we spent the rest of the afternoon and the early part of the evening visiting the Temple of Apollo, the theatre, and the stadium, and then the museum. The temple was one of the glories of the ancient world. Now all that could be seen of it, apart from the numerous fragments strewn around, were the 5 or 6 weather-beaten Doric columns, only one of them of full height and with a capital, that stood on the northeastern end of the temple's rectangular plinth, and had been probably put together from scattered drums by archaeologists in the late 19th century. The theatre, which seated 5,000 people and was situated higher up on the hillside, in the northwest corner of the sacred precinct, had for a backdrop a view of the temple and the valley beyond. It was in a much better state of preservation than the temple, which, being a place of pagan worship, had been first vandalised and then destroyed by the Christians, and seats, staircases and orchestra were all more or less intact. From the theatre, a steep path wound through pine trees up to the stadium, the tiers of seats on the north side of which had been cut out of the hillside just below the Amphissa Road. After the cluttered, uneven terraces lower down, the sight of the bare, perfectly level track, 200 yards long and 30 wide, on which the games had been held, and could still have been held, was strangely soothing. Unlike Henry Miller, I had no impression of charioteers driving their steeds over the ridge and into the blue, much less still did I find the atmosphere superhuman, intoxicating to the point of madness. Instead, all was silence, solitude, and peace. The exhibits in the museum were all from Delphi and the surrounding area. Most of them belong to the period from the 7th up to and including the 4th century BCE, and many were only fragments. There were inscriptions in Greek and Latin, mosaics, bronze dedications, metopes, Corinthian capitals, and grave goods of various kinds, from weapons to bracelets and fibulae. Above all, there were the freestanding sculptured figures, of which I particularly remember the charioteer, the two brothers, and the statue of Antinous. The charioteer stood erect, looking a little to his right, the vertical folds of his long racing costume, the cistus, serving to accentuate the uprightness of his posture. In his right hand he grasped the reins, most of the left arm was missing. His gaze was intent but calm. Quote, "severe in youthful beauty," unquote. He stood there, having won the chariot race, and being about to take part, apparently, in the triumphal parade that was held after the race. Whereas the charioteer was of bronze and belonged to the 5th century BCE, the colossal figures of the two brothers, which were of marble, must have antedated it by at least 100 years. Cleobis and Byton were two young Argives, the sons of a priestess of Hera, who, when the oxen failed to arrive and their mother was in danger of being late for a festival, harnessed themselves to the wagon and drew her from Argos all the way across the plain to the temple. For this service they were honoured above all other men by their fellow Argives, and their statues, carved in the chunky style considered by some scholars to be characteristic of the Peloponnese, were set up in Delphi, where they remained until their discovery in modern times. One of them had an arm and a hand missing, and the faces of both were slightly damaged. Otherwise, the two colossi were more or less intact. They stood side by side in the room bearing their name, as they must have stood for centuries in the place where they were originally installed, the clenched fists of the less damaged brother suggesting that the sculptor had depicted them in the act of performing the service for which they were honoured. According to one of the books on Greece I was reading at the time, the broad faces, wide-open eyes and naked bodies of the two brothers were fixed in an almost Egyptian rigidity. Almost Egyptian, too, were the wig-like braids, three on either side, that hung down over their broad shoulders from behind their ears. What struck me most about these two massive archaic statues from the Peloponnese was not, however, their rugged strength and dignity, great as these were, so much as the fact that they had been set up in Delphi, the holiest of all the holy places of ancient Greece, by way of giving public recognition to an outstanding act of filial piety. If the charioteer bore witness to the ancient Greeks' love of sporting contests and their enthusiastic admiration for the qualities of skill and courage such contests helped promote, the two brothers bore witness to the high esteem in which they held a virtue we tend to associate less with ancient Greece than with Confucian China. Antinous was the favourite of the Emperor Hadrian, and after his death in mysterious circumstances, the afflicted monarch caused statues of the beautiful youth to be set up, even temples to be dedicated to him in cities throughout the Roman world. One such statue, evidently, had been set up in Delphi, where it was found, still standing, when a room in a building within the sacred precinct was cleared of earth and rubble in the course of excavations. belonging as it did to the 2nd century CE. It was in a style very different from that of the charioteer, and still more different from that of the two brothers, even as Antinous himself represented a type of masculine beauty that differed markedly from that of either the upstanding winner of the chariot race or the hefty young Argives who had harnessed themselves to their mother's wagon. It depicted him as the divine Ephebe, broad-shouldered but with thick, luxuriant curls and a thoughtful, almost melancholy expression. Both forearms of the statue were missing, and with them the hands, and the nose was slightly chipped. Otherwise it was complete, and one could not but admire the harmonious proportions and full contours of the young favourite's magnificent physique. With his very individual physiognomy and style of beauty, it was indeed Antinous, not Keats's Psyche, who was, quote, "the latest and the loveliest vision far of all Olympus's faded hierarchy." He was an unforgettable figure. I certainly did not forget him, and when we encountered busts and statues of him in Athens and other places in the course of our homeward journey, I recognised him immediately. What kind of impression the charioteer, the two brothers, and the statue of Antinous made on Terry, I cannot say. He undoubtedly felt much more at home with the art of ancient Greece than he did with Christian art, especially as so much Greek sculpture, whether of the archaic or the classical period, was devoted to the representation of the human figure, and could be appreciated for its formal and expressive qualities, without that knowledge of sacred history and religious symbolism that was often essential to a proper understanding of Christian art. Nonetheless, despite his having appeared to enjoy the sculptures in the museum, it was not long before Terry was again feeling depressed, and not long, therefore, before we were having another of our little talks. We had it not sitting in the shade of the olive trees, but parked beside a rubbish tip outside Castri, from which, by way of contrast, there was a fine view of the Gulf of Corinth. This time I was more successful in my efforts to cheer him up, and some days were to pass before he again felt depressed. So successful was I, that in the morning, the two of us having gone down to the Tholos, he was happily taking photographs of the mysterious circular structure, just as the rays of the rising sun struck the tops of the three remaining Doric columns. That day was perhaps the best day of our holiday so far, such is the testimony of my diary at least. Not that we did a lot of sightseeing, in fact we did none at all. Having breakfasted, we found a sheltered nook above the theatre and there spent the greater part of the day, returning to the little bus only in order to bring a flask of tea and something to eat up to the spot where we had established ourselves. Above our heads, there was nothing but blue sky. Immediately below our feet, only the theatre descending the hillside in tier after semicircular tier to the level on which stood the temple all around. And so far as the eye could see, the landscape was steeped in clear, bright, invigorating sunshine, which, as the sun ascended, threw shorter and shorter blue shadows. Probably because it was a weekday, there were far fewer people than the day before, and the sounds that came up from the little groups of tourists wandering among the ruins reached our ears but faintly. In the course of the morning, I read Euripides's Ion. It was no coincidence that I was reading this particular play in this particular place, for the scene of the play was Delphi, in the forecourt of the very temple of Apollo, on which Terry and I were then looking down, and I deliberately postponed the reading of the work to this moment. Ion is an attendant in the temple, at the entrance to which he was found as a baby. Now grown to manhood, he has been made treasurer of the god and steward of all trust, and when we first see him, he is busy decorating the portals of the temple with garlands of bay leaves, sprinkling the pavement with water from the Castalian spring, and scaring birds away from the offerings with his bow and arrows. Among those approaching the oracle is Creusa, queen of Athens. She and her husband Xuthus king consort of Athens, are childless, and she wants to know if they will have issue. From the exchange that takes place between her and Ion, we learn that she wishes to question the oracle secretly on behalf of a friend, and that she does not want her husband to know of this. The question concerns the fate of the child whom this friend, without her father's knowledge, bore to Apollo some years ago and then abandoned. Their conversation is interrupted by the arrival of Xuthus, who has been consulting the oracle of the hero Trophinius. While not presuming to forestall the utterance of Apollo, Trophinius has assured the king that neither he nor his wife will return home from Delphi childless. Having broken the joyful news to Creusa, Xuthus exits to the inner temple, where Apollo speaks through the lips of the Pythia, leaving Ion to wonder why Creusa should seem to rail upon the god, and Creusa's attendant handmaids, who form the chorus to sing the praises of the virgin goddesses Pallas Athene and Artemis, Apollo's sisters, as well as to celebrate the joy of having sons to continue the family line and inherit the ancestral wealth, and to lament the fact that the offspring of the gods by mortal women are never happy. The sound of their voices has hardly died away before Xuthus is back. Dramatic time and real time do not coincide. Apollo has spoken. He has told Xuthus that the first man he meets on leaving the inner temple is his truly begotten son. As it happens, the first man he meets is Ion. Initially, Ion refuses to believe that Xuthus is his father and angrily repulses him. But eventually he is convinced, Xuthus having admitted, under questioning, that in his younger days he had visited Delphi at the time of the nocturnal Bacchic orgies and taken part in them in the company of the local girls. Ion must be the fruit of that visit, and father and son, overjoyed, fall into each other's arms. Creusa is far from overjoyed. On learning from the chorus that Apollo has given Xuthus a son, while she remains childless, she is distraught with anger and grief, and when a loyal old servant offers to kill Ion while he and Xuthus are feasting, she gives him a deadly poison with which to do the deed. On no account will she allow her husband's bastards to inherit the throne of Athens. A timely omen having frustrated the plot at the last moment, the old servant confesses everything. The rulers of Delphi condemn Creusa to death for attempted murder within the sacred precinct, and Ion comes with a band of armed men to carry out the sentence. He finds Creusa sitting on the altar in front of the temple, where she has taken refuge, and a fierce altercation takes place between them. At this point, the Pythia enters, bearing the ark in which, as a baby, Ion was found at the entrance to the temple. Creusa recognizes the ark, and without seeing them, is able to describe the objects it contains, objects which she herself once placed there. She has found her son, and Ion has found his mother. Mutual hate is transformed into mutual love, and both are beside themselves with joy. But who, Ion wants to know, is his father? Is it Apollo, as Creusa maintains? Or is it Xuthus, as Apollo himself, apparently, has declared? He is about to go and ask the god when there appears, high above the temple, in a blaze of light, an awe-inspiring figure. It is Pallas Athene in her chariot. She has come from Athens with a message from Apollo. He is indeed Apollo's son by Creusa, he tells Ion, and Creusa is to take him with her to Athens and seat him on the throne of her fathers. He will have four sons, who will give their names to the four Athenian tribes, the descendants of whom will spread overseas and be called Ionians. Creusa and Xuthus too will have offspring, but Xuthus is to be kept in ignorance of Ion's true parentage. Apollo has done all things well, the goddess tells Creusa in conclusion. Having given her an easy delivery, he caused Ion to be brought up in his own temple and has saved him from death by means of a timely omen. Creusa thankfully acknowledges this, and the play ends with the chorus hailing Zeus and Apollo, and affirming their belief that those who, despite adversity, continue to honour the divine powers, at last attain their right. Iron was an enthralling work. It was based on a story of deep human interest, and with its sudden reversals of fortune, its violent confrontations, its eloquent speeches, its dazzlingly beautiful lyric flights on the part of the chorus, flights that could be appreciated to an extent even in English translation, and its daring exploration of the mystery of divine justice, it was proof that Euripides fully deserved his place as one of the three master tragedians of ancient Greece, little as he may have been appreciated in his own day in comparison with his two great rivals. As I read the play that morning in our nook above the theatre, every now and then raising my eyes from the page to look down at the remains of the temple in whose forecourt the action took place, it was as though I could see the drama unfolding before me. Indeed, it was as though I saw not buskined actors, but living human beings moving and speaking there. I saw Ion decorating the portals of the temple, saw the arrival first of Creusa and then Xuthus, saw Ion repulsing and finally embracing his supposed father, saw Creusa give poison to the old servant, saw her taking refuge on the altar in front of the temple, saw the Pythia enter with the ark, saw mother and son reunited at last, even saw, high above the temple roof, in the midst of the blue sky, the majestic figure of Pallas Athene, helmeted and carrying a spear, and with her breast covered by the aegis. In Euripides' Andromache II, which I read that afternoon, the Delphic oracle plays a crucial role, though the scene of the play is the temple of Thetis in Pythia, a town in Thessaly. All the principal cities and people of ancient Greece appear to have maintained close relations with Delphi and its presiding deity, as was evinced by the little temple-like state treasuries, or their ruins, that could be seen lining the sacred way, much of it still paved, that wound up through the sacred precinct to the temple. Delphi and Athens, Apollo and Pallas Athene, enjoyed particularly close relations. It was therefore fitting that at 7 o'clock that evening, having paid a second visit to these souvenir shops without my buying anything, Terry and I should have left Delphi for Athens, following the very route via Lebadea that Ion, Creusa and Xuthus had followed in the distant, legendary past.